Welcome back to Tay Talks. I'm glad to have you here today with a dear friend, Lisa Yen, who is a fellow patient advocate in the neuroendocrine space. Lisa and I have known each other for several years now and bond over our love of travel. We tend to meet up at all the major neuroendocrine tumor conferences and oncology conferences that we both overlap in. I hope you guys enjoy this episode and enjoy our little shenanigans that we talk about. We both did a day trip, like fly in, fly out, same day to go see Jeremy Strong in Enemy of the People on Broadway. Amazing, amazing, amazing show. If you guys ever have the chance to go see that again, I really hope they bring it back because that truly was an incredible show. Lisa is super active on social media, so follow her, connect with her, and if you have any questions for her, feel free to reach out directly or through me, and we can always try to bring her back. Enjoy. Book or movie you think does not deserve the hype?
Ooh, this is gonna be controversial. Harry Potter. I think the writing is not that good. Oh, that's so hard. Do I have to pick one?
Top three.
I love Taipei. I would have to pick somewhere in Italy. Paris has a special place in my heart. My goodness. Come From Away, I think hands down, it's all around one of the best musicals, one of the best shows ever. And it has everything in it with music and staging and a great ensemble kind of piece. It's not dependent on one character. And the story is incredibly moving. And it's based on history, but very uplifting and inspiring. And it spoke to me at a very challenging time in our lives, too. So really meaningful. That was the first time he was ever hospitalized. And it was completely unexpected. I mean, when he was directly admitted, I dropped him off admitting. I went and rounded on my patients and sat in the room doing my notes, my soap notes while he's like getting blood transfusions. And I'm pretty calm. I'm pretty reasonable. I thought it's not a big deal. You know, whatever is going to happen, we'll take care of it. And what was discovered was completely and utterly unexpected. Because of how advanced the tumors were and how much trouble they were causing, all hell broke loose. So if she hadn't asked me at that time, at that moment, I probably would have already gone down a different path. And, well, Giovanna is very convincing. She's very convincing and you can't say no to her. Yeah, but she showed me that her inviting me into this world of patient advocacy was a blessing to me. And it was, again, not something I would have thought of or pursued or anything. I was in this community for my husband, for our own lives, and not really thinking of how anything I would, any of my skills, strengths, knowledge, experience could benefit other people. I didn't know. I didn't really think of that at all.
The first thing I'll ask you is, when was the last time you laughed till you cried that you can remember?
I really love audiobooks. Okay. I listen to a ton of audiobooks and I listen to a range of them, but one of my favorite genres are rom-coms. I just really like things that are lighthearted, guaranteed to have a happy ending. And one of my favorite authors is Catherine Center. So I drove down a couple weeks ago for a author talk at Public Library in Orange County. It's like an hour drive down there just to see her talk. But she is so hilarious. My twin sister and I, my niece all went and we're sitting in the front row and we just laughed so hard. It was a really great time.
I've never heard of her, but I think I'm going to look her up. I opened up a tab so that I can look up a book after this. I love that. So I don't think I've ever read a rom-com in a book.
They're especially pleasant. Well, I think books in general are especially pleasant via audio. So especially after graduating school. Yeah. I didn't necessarily read a lot because when are we ever sitting? And I was always the kind of person, even during school, I wasn't always the best student. I did well, I excelled, but I found it very difficult to study. And what I realize now looking back is it's because I had a difficult time reading and I'd always fall asleep. But actually during grad school, when I went back to school for a nurse practitioner, I recorded my lectures. And because I had a long commute because of LA traffic, I was listening to them over and over again.
Okay.
And that's when I realized I'm a little bit of an audio learner. Not like fully, but I am an audio learner. And then maybe 10 years ago, one of my good friends turned me on to audiobooks. And my initial concept and what I thought audiobooks were was always like something that was just really not necessarily well written, not high quality. But this friend of mine, she's a lawyer. She was listening to Don Quixote and high level, high quality books. And I didn't know that all of that was available, and also through the public library. So it was free and not through a paid service. So I started listening to it. And what I found was, not through driving, because it wasn't, I don't actually like to listen to audiobooks when I drive, because again, LA traffic. But when I'm doing mundane things like folding laundry, cooking, chopping vegetables, things like that, it really makes the time go by faster for mundane tasks. And I also really listen to it, enjoy it, and retain it. So anyways, that started my whole audiobook journey. And I listened to quite a range, and I learned a lot. I mean, things from memoirs and nonfiction to fiction. And it depends on what's going on in my life, if I want something light or something heavier.
Yeah, I've always been an avid reader. I mean, I was the type of kid that would go to the library every week and bring 30 books home and all of that. So, and you're right, when you go to college, you're like booked out. You don't have the energy for it. You just want to disconnect. I went to TV after college. I never watched TV when I was younger. I started binge watching series. And then until now, I just rewatch in the background because I don't have the time to sit and dedicate time to TV, but I can just rewatch and re-listen in the back. But books, yeah. I tried to get into audiobooks, and the only type of audiobooks I can do are memoirs, and they have to be read by the author. Those I enjoy a lot. I haven't been able to find a good fiction that I can listen to. I do tend to still read those, but if you're saying that these are good, I think I'll...
Yeah, it's all about the narrator with audiobooks, right?
Yeah.
And some of them are done as audio dramas, so they're the whole cast.
Yeah.
Some of them, the narrators are actors, like professional actors, stage or film actors that you may have known of.
Yeah.
So in particular, Catherine Senner's books actually are narrated by an actor who's a Broadway stage actor, but because of COVID, didn't have work. So she shifted and did audiobooks, as did many actors, actually. It really elevated the level of audiobooks, especially when you find those narrators that are really entertaining.
You're a big Broadway.
I am.
And theater kid. Were you a theater kid growing up, like acting, or you just enjoyed watching?
I just really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed singing and choirs. I was never really good or anything. It was like background group choir. I did choir for most of my growing up years and school years, like school choir. And actually played 12 years of piano as well. Again, was not very good.
But I feel like if you did 12 years, then you were probably good.
I was a hard worker, but I did not have a gift. That's the thing. Okay. And same with singing. I really appreciated live music and theater. And I was very fortunate because the high school I went to had a performing arts high school on campus.
Cool.
So I went to school with Pedro Pascal.
Really?
He was in my grade, in my English class, and other people like him, people who won Tonys on Broadway.
Wow.
So that's the level of theater that I was exposed to, the level of talent during my high school years. And I remember seeing a production of Into the Woods in high school, and that just changed my whole perspective because I loved it so much. I was like, this is what shows can do. It can make you feel all those things. It can open your eyes, change your perspectives. I just went away feeling like something had shifted and changed. I mean, I am not that talented, but I really can appreciate what art can do.
What was the first Broadway show that you saw in New York?
Ooh, in New York City. Yeah. So the first shows that we saw School of Rock.
Okay.
And maybe Come From Away and Hamilton the same year. I could be mixing it up, but I remember School of Rock was one of them. And I probably saw at least another. Oh, no. You know what it was? It was An American in Paris.
Okay.
An American in Paris.
Yeah.
That was really special.
And what year was that?
16, I believe. 2015 or 2016. It was after Tom was diagnosed with neuroendocrine cancer. So New York was one of our first trips. I think that was 2015. It was pretty tough, but I do remember American Paris because we got like handicapped seats and everything. And it was really challenging for him to even sit through a show and all that, but just very memorable and very special for us.
Nice. Very nice. What's been your favorite?
It's hard to pick a favorite, and we kind of have them in categories. I kind of have like the top bucket.
I love that.
And the kind of middle. But my favorites, I love Come From Away. I think hands down, it's all around one of the best musicals, one of the best shows ever. And it has everything in it with music and staging and a great ensemble kind of piece. It's not dependent on one character. And the story is incredibly moving. And it's based on history. Very uplifting, inspiring. And it spoke to me at a very challenging time in our lives too. So really meaningful. I've seen it several times, as I have also Hamilton, which is just so enjoyable. I watch it over and over again. Those two are really, really enjoyable. I mean, there's a lot of theater out there, of course. And I know you and I shared a really special experience. I was just thinking about that this morning as well.
I want another experience like that. So for anybody who doesn't know what we did, you tell a story better than I do. So go for it.
Well, you and I were in Miami for a Nanette's conference. And I know that my husband and I were planning to go to New York next. And just over dinner, you were casually asking, what shows are you going to see? And I told you, and then you kind of mentioned, oh, I really want to see a show. And I asked you which show, and you said, Enemy of the People. So yeah. You kind of said, oh, well, I said, oh, you should go see it. You said, oh, I don't know. I said, I'd go see it with you. And so it just so happened you were game and I was game. And since I was going to New York, I went to the box office and I said, hey, I would like two tickets for this day. And they happened to have these really amazing seats. And we did it. We did a one-day trip that was just really amazing and memorable.
It was. And I think what was making me hesitate was that I didn't have the bandwidth or calendar to be able to go for a weekend or to spend some time up in New York. It wasn't even on my mind that I could just go fly up, see a show and come back. So since then I've done it. I did it again, the whole fly up and fly back. I'm like, I'm going to take advantage of this East Coast thing as long as I can. So, you know, there's flights to LaGuardia all day. I mean, I highly recommend. I think that was something, it was a beautiful day. I would do it again.
I really love that. I love that you were game and it showed that you were willing and capable of living in the moment, right? Being spontaneous and just leaning into fun. And that's what life is about, like making the most of the moments, not waiting for them to pass by.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I love that fun can be defined as different things, right? Like to you and me, that's a thrill for me, is like going and spending a beautiful day with somebody that you love, getting to make a memory. And yeah, it doesn't have to be anything super crazy. It just has to be memorable. And like you said, making the most of whatever you're in.
Yeah, I think I really learned that it's really important to take the opportunity when it's there, because sometimes we're like, oh, I'll wait till there's a better time in my life. I'll wait. But sometimes the times pass us by. And in a small way, I mean, there's been, as you know, shows are only open for so long, especially certain actors. And there's been shows that I've regretted missing. And
really?
You just can't rewind time and go back and be like, I'm going to see that show because it's no longer available. And that's just like one small example. I know this isn't a meaningful example, but that kind of thing, like just making the most of the opportunity when it's present and jumping on it and carpe diem.
Yeah, 100%. I don't think it's not important. It is important, right? We're not doing anything wrong.
No.
I get what you mean. Like it is, nobody needs to go see a Broadway show, right? But it, just like there's people that are healthcare workers and there's people that are lawyers and there's people that are first responders. Those are all important jobs, I think. Actors and theater and all of that, there is a role for that in the world, and it helps people to I think you grow sometimes when you see art, especially the way you see art. I think you really look into everything very deeply and you engage with it in a way that not a lot of people do. You have appreciation for all the little things, and so I think those things, while it is a nice, fun, seize the moment, unwind kind of thing, sometimes you learn the most from the smallest little encounters.
Yeah, no, it's so true. Art has the ability to broaden our perspective, change our perspective, and deepen conversation. Most of all, to deepen empathy, right? Really to understand someone else's story. Yeah. And I just, you know, the whole thing about carpe diem and making the most of the present, it was really a life lesson. I mean, it's a small way that we're applying it with theater, but, you know, it's true in life too. So, and I know you do that too.
Yeah. So you grew up in L.A. or where did we grow up?
That's a complicated question. You want the full story?
Let's unpack it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was technically born in the U.S., but only because my mom flew to the U.S. to birth my twin sister and I. And then she flew back to Taiwan where we're from. And I spent the first 5 years of my life there. Okay. So I'm born a U.S. citizen. And English was not my first language because I did not live here until right before starting kindergarten. And I was dropped off on the doorstep of my kindergarten classroom, not knowing a word of English and not knowing what was going on for most of the year. And then having to go to ESL. And that happened in Tampa, where you're from. So right. That was those first 3 years of my life as an immigrant child in a place that was predominantly white and not really open to different cultures or people who spoke different languages or from different places. And it was pretty challenging. And even traumatic. My father was an OBGYN, but as a foreign medical graduate, he had to retake his exams and repeat his training. So during those 3 years, as he was studying to take his exams, his English proficiency, and then a USMLE to redo his residency, he opened a Chinese restaurant that he and his brother ran. And we struggled through those 3 years. And then he was able to get into a residency program in Detroit. So we moved there. He repeated his OBGYN training in Detroit. And that was also very challenging because that was during the 80s when there was a lot of issues with racism because of what was going on with the automobile industry. And there were deaths, there were murders of Asians.
Oh, gosh.
It was a very challenging time, is there?
Very scary. And then my goodness.
Yes. And when he completed that, we were looking to move either back to Florida or to California. And then my family moved to California. Yeah. So after my father finished his repeat residency, then we moved to California. Then he started working first. Actually, he first worked at Cedars and then he opened a private practice.
Nice. Nice. Did you always know that you were going to be a nurse? Did you always have a very helping personality, I'm going to define it as, or was that something that came up later?
Yeah, no, this is an interesting story. Because my whole family is in medicine. So my father is an OBGYN. Both my grandfathers are OBGYN. We were birthed by my mom's cousin, who's an OBGYN. And yeah, so many people in the medical field and my uncles, a lot of them are physicians. And seeing what my father went through, because I was growing up during those years while he was doing his residency. He didn't complete it until I was in eighth grade. So I never saw my father. He was either on call or moonlighting. So when he was home, he was sleeping and we were told to be quiet. So I never saw my father for those 4 or 5 years. So my impression of medicine and the training it required was not a positive one. And I vowed I would never go into medicine of any kind.
Yeah.
I knew that there were many ways to help people. Yeah. And I was interested in how humans worked and in their minds and brains and their psyche. And so I thought I would go into something psychology or sociology focused and maybe be a teacher or something like that. And when I was in high school and exploring this, my sister, who was interested in going to medicine, she dragged me along with her to do some candy striping at a community hospital. And again, my impression of nurses was not very positive because I thought that they were what I had seen just in clinics and hospitals was not necessarily a positive one. And when I was candy striping, one of the times I was called to go to the pediatric ICU just to hold a baby. And while I was there, the nurse who was taking care of the baby, she really impressed me. She was a young, beautiful nurse. She was a UCLA grad. Seemed really intelligent, and she was going back to school as a lawyer. And I was really amazed by how intelligent she is and proficient. And I thought, well, this is not what I thought nurses do or how they are. And that kind of sat with me. They were just highly intelligent, highly skilled, and it just kind of changed my impression of who they were and what they could do. And then as I was kind of exploring and really thinking about it, and I was, you know, really a person of faith and praying about, like, what should I do with my life? And I really felt, I was 16 years old, so really still young. And I was just like, you know, God, what do you want me to do with my life? And it was really one of those moments where I clearly felt like I heard a calling. Lisa, I want you to be a nurse. So I said, okay, I applied to nursing schools, but my applications, I actually applied to 3 of the top schools in the country and I got into them. And then I applied to non-nursing track program. Actually, it was Wheaton College and I ended up going there, which was very counterintuitive. And I turned down the other programs, they were so mad because they were like, we turn out the top graduates who become administrators and all of this, and you're going to a program that doesn't even have a nursing program. They had a pre-nursing program, and actually a lot of the graduates ended up going directly to nurse practitioner. So my whole schooling route, even though I knew at 16 I was going to be a nurse, it was counterintuitive, right? I went to a program that didn't have nursing. I ended up majoring in psychology. Remember, I said I was interested
in that. You said that.
And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. This first time I was introduced to the concept of neuroscience as well, and how there's a whole mind, body, soul, spirit connection. And this is, again, a long time ago. This was when the whole concept was just evolving. And I did an independent study on that. A whole body connection.
That's awesome.
Imagine that. That was like new, novel. And then I went from there. I felt like, okay, it didn't make sense to transfer after 3 years. So I completed my degree in psychology. And while I was there, I took all sorts of classes that were interesting to me. I actually dabbled in ESL, and I realized teaching was probably not for me. And I took all sorts of different classes that were interesting, but, you know, it gave me a really broad view of just what's out there, English, literature, and arts and music, just everything, and not just science focus. And I went back and I got a second degree in nursing in an accelerated program at Loyola University. A second degree program was really interesting because those people are highly motivated, because like me, had already had a bachelor's, and we were investing a lot of money into an accelerated program for, I think it was like a 12 or 13 month program where we were finishing our degree in a year. So really like kind of cream of the crop people is a competitive program. And we were also assigned the best professors.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting. And then going to Loyola Medical Center for the rotation was really interesting as well. Yeah. So I had thought that it made sense to me, since my dad was an OB, that maybe I would go into midwifery. And then I hated my rotation.
You were really trying hard to make the family thing like stick, and it was just like, no.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many times where I thought I knew. I had planned it all out.
Yeah.
And every time I was at a crossroads or I started down a path, I would be thrown a curveball or taken on a detour, or what I thought would be a detour. Yeah. So what other people would say made sense isn't the path I went on. A lot of people kept saying to me many times, number one, you can't know when you're 16 what you're going to do. Number two, if you know what you're going to do, why didn't you just do it? Like none of this made sense to other people. And then even after I graduated, people were shocked that I actually did end up going through with it. And they were like, you did say this when you were 16. And 10 years later, they saw me and they're like, wow, I can't believe you actually did it. I'm like, well, I told you, this was a calling. It says things when they're in high school and they don't mean it or things change. And that's true too. But I really did feel like it was a calling. And for me, it had to be calling because I knew that I did not want to do it. I did not want to go into medicine because I knew how challenging it would be. So the only way I was going to do it was if it was truly a calling for me. So I know that a lot of my classmates actually went straight into nurse practitioner school because they were like, you know, might as well. That's what I want to do anyways. But for me, again, I thought I didn't feel right doing that without having some nursing under my belt. I thought that would make me a more competent and thoughtful nurse practitioner. And honestly, not a big fan of school. So I wanted to be done as soon as I could. And I got out and I worked for 3 years, first in cardiac intensive care and then in cardiothoracic intensive care. So first with patients who had medical heart issues, heart attacks and such, and then open heart surgery for a couple of years. And I actually really, really loved it. I loved it so much. I loved all the tech. I loved the unit I worked on. I was in Indianapolis, and the way that they functioned there, especially because I worked night shift, they gave us a lot of autonomy. So all the nurses were ones who extubated patients, who took out the central lines and ran these high-tech machines that maybe in other places they wouldn't, or maybe on different shifts. And we had a resident there, you know, that was on the unit, but we were given a lot of autonomy and really supported and empowered. So I thought it was really interesting stuff. And then I spent 2 months in Kenya in the year 2000. I was at a hospital there. It was staffed mostly by missionaries. And when I was there, it completely changed my life, Tay. I mean, really, I went in completely open. I had no idea what I was going to experience, what I was going to learn. I was told, you know, you're not going to work as a nurse because you would have to go through the licensing for the state first. And I said, that's fine. I don't need to work as a nurse.
Yeah.
But what they really needed was education. because that year the country had passed a law requiring nurses to do continuing education. They said, we need you to come out here and put on some classes for the nurses. Well, there was no way. I mean, number one, I didn't have background in education, but I also, how can I teach nurses things when I didn't even know what their needs were? So I spent some time just observing and learning and just watching, seeing how different things were there than they were in the US. And there were some really blatant differences. Like, for one thing, patients were in a big ward, so one big unit, no wall.
Yeah.
One big room with no walls versus individual rooms where you either have a private or shared room, but it was one big ward. Everyone of 20, 30, 40 people, 50 people were all in one big giant room. But not just that, they shared beds.
Wow.
Two. Yes. Yeah. I mean, we share rooms, but they shared beds. And furthermore, in the US, when you are put on oxygen, you have your own oxygen source, nasal cannula or such, right? You have your own one oxygen source. So you know, as a clinician of any kind, when you turn up the oxygen, that's the amount of oxygen one person's getting. Yeah. They have many people connected to one oxygen source and it's connected with splitter. And so when they're turning it up to 4 liters, each person's not getting the same amount. Intuitively, you know that. The nurses didn't realize that. So even one course was just on oxygen therapy. It was really interesting. And, you know, it was really an interesting experience. I really was inspired by the nurses there and by what I saw, because medicine there is very different and the issues that they encounter were really different. A lot of it was malaria. So a lot of young people who were really ill. And then I remember going to a clinic that was staffed mostly by a nurse. And when I say a nurse, it's not at the level of education that nurses in the US are.
Right. Did you compare it to like a CNA or like an MA here?
Like an MA. It was a diploma program.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And they know things, of course, but it's not as academically rigorous. And it's more that they definitely learn by association versus really developing the critical thinking skills. And similarly for the physician education program, it was more like an internship versus they didn't have residencies and such. And of course, this is 25 years ago. Things have developed. But I went to a rural clinic that was normally staffed by a nurse or a medical assistant. However, one day a month, they would send a physician of some sort or a medical student. Not even, you know, because they had visiting staff coming. And I was amazed because I saw a young woman there and she had had rheumatic heart disease. So she had a really loud murmur. And I knew by association from my training what was going on, but I really saw that I lacked the diagnostic skills to really think critically and go through the differential diagnosis and the whole process of a thorough evaluation and workup. So I didn't have that training. And that's when I really realized, okay, it was time to go back to school. And so after I returned from Kenya, that's when I started looking into nurse practitioner program and moved back to California. And I went to UCLA for nurse practitioner school. So because of that program, I actually thought, okay, well, it made sense to do family nurse practitioner. And then I would have a broad base training and understanding and be able to work in rural areas and things like that. However, I have to confess, after 2 weeks in the program, I was bored to tears because a lot of it's so mundane, like prevention and all this. I was so bored. And I was talking to my really good friend and I realized, you know what? I love the adrenaline of all of the hospital medicine stuff that I've always been exposed to. And I did not want to just think about prevention and vaccine schedules and all of these things. I also wanted to take care of people who were critically ill and really being able to fix sick people. So I switched to acute care nurse practitioner. My actually intention was to become an ER nurse practitioner. So I did most of my training in the ER. I did all these rotations in the emergency room. And then when I graduated,
of course,
I was offered. So my last few rotations were at Olive View Medical Center, which I loved. I loved it. It's a county hospital. It's a little different from inner city county. It's more like, it is county, but more community county hospital.
Yeah.
And the patients were really special. A lot of non-English speaking, but they're very appreciative. And it was really, really special to serve an indigent population like that. And the residents that I worked with and the staff, they're really remarkable. And I was told during those two rotations that there would not be jobs. There's rarely jobs and they weren't planning to hire. They don't use nurse practitioners in the hospitals. that was it. Like most places did not use nurse practitioners in the hospital unless it was in a specialty area like cardiology or, you know, subspecialties. However, after I graduated, I got a phone call and they said, we are starting a program and we are only reaching out to people that train with us. And I was one of four that they hired to support the residents because that year they changed the rules so that the interns could not stay more than 40 hours. It was a 40-hour rule. That was in 2003, if you think back to that. So they had to go home. So they wanted to bridge the gap with us. And so they would sign out to us and leave us with the chief resident. My deal with them is that I'd be happy to do that. I'd also like to cover the ER when the ER is doing their grand rounds. So it was me and the ER attending. So I still kept my toe in the water. And I really loved it. I loved working with the residents. I loved the exposure to hospital medicine. And it was just really broad, seeing a little of everything. And at the same time, it felt really limiting because I was only getting a taste of what was going on with patients. I wasn't following them. So I didn't know how they did over their hospitalization.
Yeah.
It was really different just being
that first touch and then, yeah.
We were doing scut work, right? Because we were the interns. We were doing scut work, which is fine as a first job, but not as a long-time career. Right. So after a while, I was itching to do more. And a friend of mine who was working at a small community hospital said, Lisa, come join me. We are hiring another nurse practitioner. They have no residents. Fellows here, and they basically use the nurse practitioners as such because, you know, the doctors, they round, they're community doctors, so they round and they go home and they need nurse practitioners to help. Then I shifted full time as a hospitalist, covering the hospital. And then from there, I joined a major managed care group as a hospitalist. And so each of those times, I was the first. I was always the first nurse practitioners in all three of these settings. And so by the time it was my third one and they were like, we really want someone to be a nurse practitioner as a hospitalist to support the hospitalist team. We don't know how it would work. Are you afraid to be the first? You know, we don't know how the doctors will accept you. I'm like, it's okay. This is what I do. I have to explain to people all the time. I really, really loved it. I especially loved the last job because they were so supportive and I worked with an amazing team, a really great team of hospitalists who were all physicians and I was only nurse practitioner. And they supported me. They empowered me. It was a great team. And I just really, really enjoyed, well, I enjoyed all of it, but I especially enjoyed that.
Yeah. Did you enjoy being the first at everything? Or is it just you don't know any differently? Would you have rather to have been coming into a program that had already seen nurse practitioners, that you had had an established place, that it wasn't such a guinea pig experience?
Well, I don't know any different. And I did like it because I was able to be part of creating something new. I was always fortunate because I had a champion at each place that they were willing to create something new and the sky was the limit. Also, I think one difference in these three positions versus other ones I may have interviewed for or talked to other colleagues who have had similar jobs is I was never under nursing. And it was, and that's different to not be under the nursing department, because if I was under the nursing department, they have a certain idea of how nurses should function and their paradigm and their role. Different. And everything might have been different. They didn't put me in a box, basically. And they really wanted to create something new. And we were able to do it in each of those places together.
Yeah. What was your favorite place that you lived in all of your adventures so far, because you've lived a little bit of everywhere?
Yeah, hands down, Southern California. Yeah. You can't beat Southern California for the weather. Yeah, after having left for 8 years and coming back, I had a much deeper appreciation for everything about it. The weather, the diversity, the beach, you know, the culture, the food, even geographically, the different landscape. I mean, you can theoretically go up in the mountains and snowboard or rock climb and then go down to the beach and surf or swim the same day.
Yeah.
And people don't think of that with Southern California, but it's so true. It's not a flat area. There's just so much to do. And that's part of what makes it so rich. And yes, challenging because it can be really congested. And it can also be so rich because of the diversity of thought, of culture, food, of everything that we're exposed to. and that is available to us. I mean, Tay, I spent so much of my life in Florida, in Michigan, even in college in the Chicago area, in Indiana, having to answer questions to other people about where I'm from. Many people commented that I have an accent. I tried to explain it's from growing up in Southern California.
Yeah.
A lot of people staring at me, you know, all sorts of things like that. People just not pretty much making really not nice comments. So it just got old after a while. And in Southern California, look, you can be anyone and do anything. And
nobody's looking almost at don't you. Blink. Yeah, yeah. That's a beautiful thing. I don't think I realized that until I leave Florida and I go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And then you feel the difference. And then you realize it is a little different. Because I grew up in Florida my entire life, right? I was born and raised here. I haven't really lived outside of it. But in the last few years, I've been obviously traveling a lot more, spending a lot more time and traveling a lot differently, I would say, as well. You know, before, when you travel, you do a few things. Now, when I travel, I like to live like a local, just go pitch my laptop at a coffee shop and hang out and just work from there for a day, do other things like that. I don't know if you notice it when you come back here to Florida, but there's a difference between Tampa and St. Pete. You go down to St. Pete and it's one culture, and you come to Tampa and it's another. So you're right. I think that value is, you
and
can't
that's
put
Tampa
a
now.
Price on that. And that's Tampa now. Yeah, exactly. Right. Not Tampa.
That was not Tampa
ago.
When I was there.
No.
I was there in the 80s. Yeah. So 40 years ago, I was, myself and my relatives and perhaps one or two other families were the only Asians in the whole greater Tampa area. Definitely got a lot of stares and all of the things. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're not in that anymore. How has it been shifting from being a clinician to being an advocate? Because I know that that wasn't also an arc that you planned for, right? That's just life happening.
Yeah.
So how has that transition been?
Yeah, it was very sudden. It was completely unplanned. And I felt like that was one decision, probably the biggest career decision that was not something I decided, but something made for me. And that's part of what made it so difficult, because I didn't feel like I had a choice.
Yeah.
What happened was in January 2015, when my husband was diagnosed with neuroendocrine cancer, he had internal bleeding with an upper GI bleed, actually admitted him to my hospital. My boss admitted him, and he went for upper endoscopy and was found to have active bleeding and put on the ventilator on life support for safety reasons. And they had to figure out quickly how to stop the bleeding. And the bleeding was because of advanced neuroendocrine tumor. That was the first time he was ever hospitalized. And it was completely unexpected. I mean, when he was directly admitted, I dropped him off at admitting. I went and rounded on my patients and sat in the room doing my notes, you know, doing my soap notes while he's like getting blood transfusions. And I'm pretty calm. I'm pretty reasonable. I thought it's not a big deal. You know, whatever is going to happen, we'll take care of it. And what was discovered was completely and utterly unexpected because of how advanced the tumors were and how much trouble they were causing. All hell broke loose. And my two bosses, my physician boss and my administrative boss said, you are taking a leave. They didn't even give me a choice. They said, you are taking a leave. So they brought the paperwork in the hospital, say, take as long as you possibly can, take a long leave of absence. And I did. I took paid and unpaid and got him better through recovering from that phase. We had a diagnosis, workup plan, went through surgery. And even with all of that, after the full 9 months, I really had a strong sense that I could not leave and go back to work, and not in hospital medicine where it was consuming. It was all consuming. I mean, I had my two phones all the time, was constantly getting paged. I was super busy and couldn't do it all and be there for my husband. Even if I could technically do it, I knew I couldn't do both well. And it was just a high degree of stress to both. And my husband needed me more. And so I resigned. I gave up that job and that career. And people often ask, well, couldn't you get another job? I mean, don't you want to do something else? And I just had that strong sense that it was not time. Like, my husband needed me more. That was my number one job. And as you know, because you and I have talked, those first, many people with neuroendocrine cancer, neuroendocrine tumor especially, it's a marathon. And so things are slow, and you can be on somatostatin analogs for a while, and then you do this, and it's very slow. But for my husband, for those first 2 years, it was a 2-year sprint. flat out sprint. And the times that he wasn't in active treatment, we were dealing with symptoms and the side effects from the treatment, from surgery and other things. But he could not drive. He could not, for 1 year, he could not even bend over to tie his shoes. I was tying his shoes for him. I was cooking and cleaning and caring for him. And a lot of it too was the psychosocial emotional support. I knew I could not leave him and go on and do my own thing. He wasn't dependent, but he needed a lot of support. And just by being nearby was important. So, and a lot of that was in taking care of a lot of the medical issues in terms of the navigating, communicating, appointments, researching the disease and making connections. 2015 was a time when things started evolving. Lanreotide was just FDA approved and the octreotide scan was still around. The dotatate scans were in clinical trials. I mean, things were evolving. So we were in the space where we were trying to figure it out. Our oncologists were trying to figure it out, like what to do. Things were shifting in the management and diagnosis. The whole thing was shifting. So honestly, it took me more than 9 months to go to a patient advocacy organization because I did not realize that that was the source of information and the latest, especially when it comes to rare diseases. I relied a lot on my own networks and I contacted everyone I knew, friends who were all sorts of physicians, especially the oncologists, but any physician, and really picked their brains as to how do you make decisions? How do you find an expert? Who do you know that might be an expert in this? I mean, I reached out wide and not a lot was known. And the word out there on the street was not, I mean, most people were like, we don't know neuroendocrine, which is understandable. And the names that were thrown out there, again, that was a time of transition because Dr. Wolin was the name that came up, but he had just moved from Cedars and left Southern California. I also have to admit, this is interesting because I tell my patients, or we talk in our community all the time about being an expert. I was at a community hospital. I was friends with all these doctors and we were getting such amazing care in terms of bedside care and the compassion. And all we wanted was a plan. And we had a plan in place. We were seen by a doctor, a surgeon who said that he could do surgery. And we did not want a second opinion. So I completely get it when people are like, we don't want a second opinion, you know, because these doctors are nice, just want a plan and you want to go with it. And so we had a plan. We had surgery with this other surgeon in place and everything. And my brother, who's a physician and works in research, went behind my back, our backs, and he called and he got an appointment. He called around. He had no idea who the experts were. He called around. He said he's a physician because he is. And he got us an appointment with an expert in neuroendocrine. And then he sat us down and he was like, okay, this is what I did.
Like, sorry. You're going to see this.
Dr. Clark, yes, I will. Sorry, not sorry, right?
Yeah.
But he knew because morbidity and mortality can be high with surgery. I mean, his intent was honestly maybe to avoid surgery, but just opening up that question, like, do you need surgery? Is this something that is necessary? And if so, you want to be with the right doctors. Like, but how do you make a thoughtful decision that is based on research and on data? And you want to go to someone who sees a lot of this, not someone who just sees a handful. Right. And this is all the things that I would say now, but I didn't buy into it then either. I get it. I know it from a personal place. And I was so mad that he was disrupting my peace. We did end up going to see that expert. And that doctor squeezed us in. It was like 5 p.m. the night before going to a major medical conference. He was supposed to be flying out that night for GI ASCO, actually. And he squeezed us in. He sat there with my husband, myself. My parents were there. I think my siblings were there. Everyone was there. And he spent a long time talking to us and explaining to us what neuroendocrine was. And he talked about what the disease was, what the landscape of it was. He said, this clinical trial just closed. You know, this drug might be in your future. It's called NETTER-1. And there's this PRT that's out there, but maybe sometime in your future. He talked about that the dotatate scans were out there under clinical trial. He gave us a lot of information. And then he had a plan. And it was really pivotal. It was completely life-changing. And looking back, of course, I can see all the mistakes that were made from the community hospital. They put my husband on an octreotide drip. They sent us home with rescue shot. My husband has a non-functional pancreatic net. They didn't know. And we didn't know. And that's the thing. You just don't know what you don't know. And getting to an expert is so critical. It's life-changing and potentially life-saving. There are things that were unnecessary. Like, we paid out of pocket for all of these octreotide shots that ended up being not necessary, right? So, but you just don't know these things. And those are just some small examples. And it ended up that he referred us to certain specialists and had the case reviewed with a multidisciplinary team and had a plan in place. And we've been with that oncologists ever since, because we established this relationship and had open communication and have continued that, where we've built trust. And through the ups and downs, we've really had open communications through it. Actually, he welcomes other input, suggestions. He sits down, he looks at research. We just feel good about the communication. And it's not that one doctor is good for everyone. It's just for us, it was a good fit.
I love that you found it. And I'm sure you were mad at your brother in the moment, but I'm glad that he did what he did. Because sometimes you do have to do that. Because when you're in the moment of receiving news that you weren't expecting, I don't think you can make all the decisions sometimes. So sometimes it's nice to have people that you trust that can take some of the burden off of you. And that thinking.
I mean, even someone like me that's in medicine, I could not think clearly. And
of course,
have to admit, I was so stressed out. I couldn't think clearly. I thought I was thinking clearly, but my level of stress and my doubt in terms of my judgment, because my husband had such advanced disease that we had no idea that this disease had been advanced. I mean, he had had neuroendocrine tumor probably for 10 years. And then this whole shock of how it was diagnosed. For the first maybe 4 to 6 months, I didn't even trust myself to drive, because I had a lot of stress when I would have to make an unprotected left. Now, an unprotected left in LA is a lot more stressful than an unprotected left in other cities. There's a lot of judgment, right, involved in like when you make that left turn. That was one way it showed in my psychological state. That's what I realized. Like, I was really excellent at compartmentalizing. I mean, I am so skilled at compartmentalizing. It was always something that I had to do in work and in my career. And then I realized, like, look, I had a lot of stress too. And this is how it showed up. And if I don't take care of my stress and take care of me, it will keep showing up in other ways. So part of also, you know, taking that leave of absence was not just to take care of my husband, but to take care of myself, because I had to put my oxygen mask on myself before my husband or anyone else. And there was no way I could be there completely for him if I couldn't take care of myself. So it really became clear to me that self-care was like my number one job, and I had to really do it.
Good. I'm proud of you for recognizing that early on. How do you maintain the balance of self-care now?
Now, that's a really good question, because it's shifted over the years. For many years, I've always been really, no, I couldn't say always, because as a kid, I wasn't very athletic at all. But as an adult in my 30s and beyond, I started really paying attention to my health and to exercise and incorporating that into my life with both aerobic and lifting and various activities. I actually started snowboarding in my 30s and rock climbing. Wow. And yeah, I didn't do any of that when I was a kid. I didn't learn to ride a bike until I was like in eighth grade. I was pretty old. I was not athletic or coordinated at all. And these are not things I was skilled at, but I just learned to do. Working out and exercise was always important to me. And I kept that up during the time that my husband was diagnosed and for several years through COVID. And there's been seasons of my life where I need certain things more than others. So after my husband was diagnosed, I had so much pent up frustration and anger. I basically said to myself, I need to hit something. And I want to hit something really, really hard. And so I picked up boxing to get out all of my angst and I loved to hit the bag and to hit mitts. And I really enjoyed that for many years. Now things have shifted. And as you know, I've had a really stressful year. And now also I have not just one dog, but two dogs. And how do I incorporate things in my life? And also with COVID and things shifted, I don't necessarily the gym with a lot of people, and I want to be conscientious about time spent away from home and germs and things. So how can I incorporate exercise in my life and in a way that's enjoyable for me? Because it always has to be enjoyable. I'm not a runner, but 2 months ago I decided, you know what, I really need to get back into exercising in a different way, in a way that makes sense. So I started running with my dog, my 4-year-old Aussie German Shepherd. And so we started running short sprints at first. And now we run 5 miles, like 5 days a week. We just ran this morning.
That's impressive. Are you going to start taking on marathons and marathon training? No, we're not there yet. You will be. Watch me talk to you in a year from now. And that's
if you had told me that I would be running, and especially that kind of distance, even half a year ago, I would be like, no, I hate running. But that's the thing. Like, I've learned through my life never to say never. If I say never, I feel like God or some higher power, somebody's going to come at me. It's going to happen. Never say never. And it's been something really enjoyable because I get to spend time with my dog. We're running outdoor. I can listen to my audiobooks and really enjoy the nice weather. So yeah, it's been a win-win in many ways.
Your favorite running playlist since you've started running?
Honestly, I listened to audiobooks during that time.
Really? Okay, I'm impressed.
I do. When I would swim or do other things, I would listen to music because I had underwater headphones. But I found with swimming, you know, music was great or other different kind of sports. But with running, I love taking every opportunity to listen to audiobooks. So I love that.
What's something from your childhood that you learned and that you still bring into every aspect of your life?
The importance of hard work. I'm really not naturally gifted at pretty much anything. My piano teacher told me I wasn't gifted. My choir teacher, I mean, I was told many times I'm not gifted. I'm not
naturally gifted. What were these adults that were around you? Oh my God.
Even in the academic courses, the teachers would kind of be like, you know, I took an anatomy course and my anatomy teacher was like, yeah, you cannot be a surgeon. You know, I was told so many times, like, you cannot do this. And I was also compared a lot. My brother is brilliant. My twin sister is really smart. I was the only one of the three of us who went to ESL that had to take SAT prep course. I was taught from an early age that I had to put in the hard work. I had to put in extra work more than other people, maybe for various reasons. And hard work can pay off. I think that that's really important to know that even if you have a gift, it's really more the hard work that takes you further. I think of like Kobe Bryant. He's famous for his work ethic. And why successful people succeed is showing up for the hard work and the practice every single day. And discipline is so important, sometimes more important than the natural gift and ability. I also really saw that it's important to do the things that bring joy. Kind of circling back to what we were talking about with theater. The things that bring joy are just so important. They bring color to your life. And so that's why it's so important to not just do the things that we feel called to do, maybe for our career or work, but the things that bring joy, even if it doesn't seem to make sense and doesn't fit in with all of that. So I studied French growing up in school for 6 years, because we were living in Michigan. It made more sense to study French. I always wanted to go to Quebec, and I thought French was really pretty. And then we moved to California, and French wasn't so practical. And I still continued to study French, and I went to France. And then I started thinking, you know, I really should learn some Spanish. But how am I going to fit this into my class schedule, into my life? And even if I did, Spanish 1 is a full year, Spanish 2 is a full year, I won't get very far in my learning of Spanish. So I went to my high school career counselor and I said, can I just skip Spanish 1 and go to Spanish 2?
Yeah.
And he was like, I think he was just used to counseling a lot of kids that are slackers. So he was just like, yeah, sure, you're a smart kid. And if you don't do well, you can always drop back after a couple of weeks. So go ahead, you know. And so he gave me the, okay, so I skipped Spanish 1. I went to Spanish 2. He signed off on it. And I had to work really hard because I had no exposure to Spanish before that. This was before
the Duolingo and, yeah.
Yeah, Duolingo. So I went to Spanish 2 and I didn't know a word and I'm learning all this stuff. But after 2 weeks, I was bored. It was going so slow. And my twin sister was studying Spanish because she started in middle school. And so after class, one day when I was hanging out with my sister in her AP Spanish class in between class break, and I was telling her that I was so bored, and her Spanish teacher, who I knew, I was telling them, I'm really bored. And her Spanish teacher said, you should just skip to Spanish 3. And I laughed out loud and I said, hi. And she goes, well, you really should. And I'm like, number one, it's never been done. And number two, I don't think I can do it. What would I do? And then number three, then what would I take next year as a senior? And she said, look, you can do it. If you can't, if you don't do well, you can just drop back to Spanish 2. And next year you take AP Spanish with me because I'm the AP Spanish teacher. And I was like, no, these are things that cannot be done. But I'm very fortunate. I always had people in my life that always challenged me to do more. There are no boundaries. There are not ceilings. Lisa, you can do these things even if you thought that this could not be done. And so I said, okay, I'll try this. I went to my counselor, said, you know what? I'm really bored. Can I skip to Spanish 3? And he goes, okay, why not? Just try it. So the junior, I'm already taking all my 5 years of French. I'm in Spanish 3 as my first year of Spanish. The next year as a high school senior, I enter my second year of Spanish, and I'm in AP Spanish with other people who have been studying for 4 years. And when I open my mouth to speak, French comes out. And my AP Spanish teacher, who teaches element like the French one, starts laughing out loud. Like, everyone's laughing. I was a fast nuns because I had no idea what was going on. I'm speaking French every time I open my mouth.
Oh, my God.
I was so far behind. And when they would play the tapes that you're supposed to translate, I had no idea what was going on. And I worked my tail off in that course, Tay. I worked so hard. I think I worked harder than any other class because I knew that I didn't have all of the years and experience that it took. And I'm not gifted in languages. I just wanted to take Spanish. That's it. Just for practicality purposes. I worked so hard. And I can tell you that that final grade, that final A that I got, was the one I was most proud of in all of my high school.
Sure, that's amazing.
I did take the AP Spanish course.
Yeah.
And at the end of the year, with the senior graduation and the awards, there's all sorts of awards that come about, and you get academic awards and all this. And then I remember very distinctly, my two teachers, the French teacher and Spanish teacher, gets up in front of the mic and start talking about the foreign language award. And they told this whole story. There's this person who's studying French and then started studying Spanish and started doing this, skipping from Spanish 2 to Spanish 3, and took AP Spanish. And this has never been done before. And they awarded me this foreign language award. And that was the award I was proud of. Yes.
Oh, that's so
I mean,
amazing.
It was something, again, it's just really unexpected. Now, can I use those languages?
I mean,
but yeah, it is really something that I'm so proud of.
You should be. That is incredible. And I think you said something earlier about even if you are talented at something, the hard work still has to go into it. And I think there's something to be said that's even more appreciated when you don't have a natural talent for something, but you put that work in and you get somewhere that even somebody who has a natural born talent for something probably couldn't, right? Like, that's amazing. Getting an A in an AP Spanish class that you had zero knowledge of 5 minutes ago, basically. That's very impressive. And I think that's incredibly motivating, I think, for anybody who is going into any field, right? Is that you really just have to be willing, find the thing that you're willing to put the work in to get to, right? Not the thing that you're best at or the thing that is going to make you the most money. Because one, the thing that you're best at may not be the thing that gives you joy, may also not be the thing that makes you money, because let's be real, these days you can make money doing anything, and you really can't pick a career based on that on its own. You really have to follow, okay, what am I going to wake up every day and want to keep doing, no matter how hard it is, right? And I think you...
For sure.
You embody that, I think, in everything that you take on.
Thank you. And you too. That's the thing. Like, we're told in life, you can't do these. These are the ceilings. These are the boundaries. This is the box you're in. Again, I'm grateful for the people who told me you can. There isn't that ceiling. You can do more. And if it weren't for people who believed in me, who said more is possible and we think you can do it, I don't think I would have even thought that these things were possible.
It's amazing. Yeah. What is,
thank you.
Let's say when you're ready to retire, which I know we immigrant children don't believe in retirement, so that's one thing, but let's say that that concept of retiring and hanging up your career hat, if you will, what are three things or three words that you would want as a legacy for people to have remembered? Okay, this is what Lisa brought to these.
A meaningful impact and changed lives.
I think that's definitely there.
I was very proud of my work as a nurse practitioner hospitalist because I felt like I could make a deep and meaningful impact. I really felt that in my work, actually, even as a bedside nurse, but as a nurse practitioner, I felt very fulfilled because I could make a change and patients felt it. And we really connected through education and through the treatment planning and even the hard conversations, you know, end of life. I could make a difference. I could make an impact. And then transitioning to patient advocacy, that was another field I did not even think existed. I did not think was for me. It was not even in my radar. It was Giovanna who invited me to come join her. Actually, I was starting down another path. I don't know if you know this. So after my husband had a really great response to PRRT, so he got PRRT before it was FDA approved, and he had a really great response. And that was the first time in over 2 years that he had stable disease at all. It really gave us our life back. And so I started thinking, what do I want to do with my life? And what I wanted to do was not necessarily to be in the space of illness, but in the space of wellness. And I wanted people to have quality of life because I saw how much my husband suffered. And it wasn't just the treatments that gave him his life back. It was managing the side effects and then his psychosocial, emotional state and dealing with depression and other things. So treatments itself didn't give him his life back necessarily. We had to manage everything else. And that's a much more complex. It's not just one magical treatment. I became a health and wellness coach through Vanderbilt's program. And it was a remote program. It was virtual. I flew there twice. And it was a rigorous program. What I love about it is that it is a health and wellness program that is specifically for healthcare professionals. So it's not for just anyone. And I looked at all sorts of programs. I was interested in the intersection of clinical medicine and how we could integrate health and wellness somehow. And it was early. You see this theme. I'm always on the cutting edge of a field. Like hospital medicine was evolving just as I graduated. Health and wellness coaching was pretty new. I think I was a fourth graduating class. I took the second ever board exam. It's a board exam that is recognized by the National Board of Medicine. And after sitting for the board exam, I met with Giovanna for lunch. And during the lunch, she said, Lisa, I'd like you to join me on staff to help plan content. I was like, Giovanna, what do you want me to do? I'm a nurse practitioner. I don't know this field. I don't know what I can add. And she said, I don't know. I just need some help planning content. And I think maybe you could help me do that. And she said, with your background in medicine as a clinician and with your background as a caregiver, I think that your perspective would be helpful. And again, as someone who believed in me, who believed that I had something of value to offer when I didn't think about it. And I was going down a different path. So I talked about it. I mean, this aligned with, of course, the values of what was LACNETS at that time, right? The Los Angeles Carcinoid Neuroendocrine Tumor Society. And we were a small, local, Los Angeles-based support group. But it aligned with her value of quality of life. And I was planning to build a business around this and coach people one-on-one. Now, I had done it through my practicum. I had 13 net patients or caregivers. Many of them were LACNETS patients or offered through LACNETS. And so we decided to wrap it in. It was actually part of our deal that we would wrap it into LACNETS.
Yeah.
So instead of me coaching them one-on-one, we would build a team because we wanted to think about sustainability. I did not have the bandwidth to be coaching one-on-one and doing other things, but I could invite some of my colleagues to do so. And in that way, also engage more people and more interest in neuroendocrine and build a team approach to this. So it is something that we offer free. Health and wellness coaching. And when I say health and wellness, it's wellness, right? We're not talking about the disease. Many people have that misunderstanding because they're coming to us for neuroendocrine tumor information. This is in the realm of wellness about how to move more and how to eat better and how to meditate or do other things, get out and walk in the environment, do things that are life-giving. So this is something we offer. We've offered it to many patients and we've done some research around it.
It's amazing how it aligned, like right at the perfect timing. You're getting ready to launch something new.
Yeah. If she hadn't asked me at that time, at that moment, I probably would have already gone down a different path. And well, Giovanna is very convincing and you can't say no to her. Her inviting me into this world of patient advocacy was a blessing to me. And it was, again, not something I would have thought of or pursued or anything. I was in this community for my husband, for our own lives, and not really thinking of how any of my skills, strengths, knowledge, experience could benefit other people. I didn't know. I didn't really think of that at all. So in terms of retirement, how that would shift also with neuroendocrine, both as in my career as a clinician and then as neuroendocrine, those words mean the same. Meaningful impact and change lives. It looks different. With clinical work, I was really looking at impacting individuals or families. And with patient advocacy, I'm looking at the greater community and what we could do to really change the field, move the field forward together.
I'm not going to ask you if you have plans for something after or along with or anything like that, because your life has its own plans. But is there something else on your mind that you would like to pursue? Doesn't have to be professional, just something that, you know, you were learning French for a while, you were learning Spanish. Is there something that you just haven't blocked out the time to work on or haven't had the ability to do that is on your mind?
That's a great question. I feel like similar to how you and I flew to New York to see the one show, I've really taken advantage of the time and the shift in my life and career pacing and the autonomy I have with my schedule to be able to do more. So I actually even took a culinary course. You know, I did a lot of things in these last 10 years. I've really explored and tried to do as much as I wanted to do. I don't know if there's other things, but I'm sure there are. I mean, there's places I want to travel to. It sounds really big, but now I realize, you know, there is nothing too big. I really, really would love there to be a cure for neuroendocrine cancer. I mean, we all should be hoping that. So whatever we can do together to find a cure, true cure. I know we hesitate to use that word. That's what we hope for. That is our goal, right? Ultimately. I mean, we hedge and all that, but yeah, we want that.
Well, hopefully in the very near future, I would love to see that. I mean, look at the light years we've come in just the last 10 years. You're talking about lanreotide and Afinitor being approved, you know, in the beginning of your path on this. And now we've come really night and day. It's not even remotely close. The
Amazing.
Way we're diagnosing, treating, the recognition that the field has. I think it's made its way into like 3 Grey's Anatomy episodes at this point as not such a rare thing. So it's making its rounds into people's lives. And I think that with that comes the support to get to the point that we have a cure for NETs and for all cancers across the board. Cancer is such an ugly thing, and I think it affects everybody in some way, shape, or form. I'm incredibly grateful for the community that is the oncology world. I think that it also has, maybe by design, maybe by chance, some of the most incredible people in the world. And I think altogether, we'll eventually get there.
Really an incredible community. I mean, you cannot underestimate what is possible because of this community. I have to say, Tay, I've told my husband this multiple times. I could not imagine doing anything better than this. Of all of the things I've done in my life, this, where I'm at now, is the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. And I'm so happy doing it because I feel like it's deep and meaningful work. And a lot of that, it's not just content creation and doing educational content. It's all of this. And it's this involvement in the community and feeling like together we can really do a lot. We can make a deep and meaningful impact.
Absolutely. Rapid fire. Okay. First thought that comes to mind when I ask you these questions. So Jeopardy, what's a category you could sweep without prep?
Oof.
Okay, with a little bit of prep. If you had to pick something.
I don't think I could sweep any category.
I feel like you could easily have said neuroendocrine for this one and you could probably sweep it, but we're moving on. Okay. That wasn't even what I was thinking. I mean, like Broadway would have been one for you. I think you underestimate how much you probably know in that category, but okay, fine. What's an irrational fear?
I don't feel like I know anything.
Have?
I'm actually really terrified of heights, and that's part of why I picked up rock climbing.
Okay. Look at you conquering your fears, literally. Wow. Favorite city that you've ever visited?
Oh, that's so hard. Do I have to pick one?
Top 3.
I love Taipei. It's where I'm from. The food is really phenomenal. I would have to pick somewhere in Italy. Again, it's hard to pick one because I loved them all. And my husband and I have been to Italy 3 times in the 19 years we've been married. And the third one, I would probably have to say Paris has a special place in my heart. I went when I was 16 studying French. And I plan to go take my sister again this year for our very special milestone birthday en route to the Inca Summit.
What is always in your carry-on bag? Like, what do you not ever travel without?
Hand sanitizer.
And last one, what is a very popular book or movie that you think does not deserve the hype?
This is going to be controversial. Harry Potter.
Really?
I've actually read all the Harry Potter books. It's controversial. I really want to end with that.
Interesting. Like, wow. Okay.
I read all the books. I read them all when they were first released in hardcover the day it's published. I read all sorts of books. I love stories, and I just don't think the storylines make sense. And I think the writing is not that good. So I think it's overhyped.
I am going to have to reread them this year and have to see if I feel the same. Because I don't currently feel the same. So I'm going to have to see. Oh my goodness.
I get it. It is entertaining. But there's Harry Potter world and all the Harry Potter things. I mean, it's amazing.
Gone a little far. But I think that can be said for anything that gets.
But then there are really special stories that like don't get that. And I think that's the thing. I love stories.
Give me one that you think is very underrated.
There are so many, actually.
Okay, give me my next book. What should I read?
Well, I recently finished Project Hail Mary, and I just really loved it. I actually just finished Taylor Jenkins Reid's Atmosphere, which is in the similar line of space. Okay. There are so many. I'm like, which one should I recommend? I love Catherine Center. If you want something light, so I don't always want something heavy because life is hard. So when I need something light, rom-coms are the go-to. Ones that have significant stories. I mean, they're not just fluff, but they touch on challenging topics and yet the character development and the story. So I love the Catherine Center books. I also really like Abby Jimenez. They both have a way to bring in humor and romance and tie them in with difficult topics. But I love memoirs of all varying types. There are some really tough ones and there are very heartwarming. There's a whole range of them.
All right. You've given me a little bit of a reading list. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would like to touch on?
Well, I think that your overall theme of looking at careers and career paths and how they can be circuitous or just the unexpected, I think is really fascinating. I really applaud you for doing that. I think it aligns with my life of living with neuroendocrine because it's a lot of living in the unexpected. The unknown and unexpected. And I thought I had a lot of resilience because of all these things that I've shared with you, with the ups and downs of my life and my work and career and choices. And perhaps that brought in those skills and strengths into living the unexpected now with work and career and caregiving. And even though things are challenging, and I'm sure you see this too in your life, it's not all bad. It's not all good or all bad. It's all of it all together. Being open to the unexpected, I mean, you never know what's on the other side of the door or beyond the ceiling. And it could be the most beautiful things that you could not have ever even imagined. I'm excited for you too in your journey.
Thank you.
I know you to be someone who already does amazing, impressive work. And I cannot wait to see what you continue to do.
I'm so grateful to have you. And to get to know you and get to be part of your journey and you part of mine. And I can't wait to get to connect in each of our places, you know, and get to continue to share in all the milestones and all the new things. And I'm so happy we got to have this conversation because I got to learn things that I didn't know about you. And I think that anybody listening to this is going to be honestly inspired and in awe of you, just like I am as your friend. I think the world's a better place with you in it. So very grateful for you, Lisa. Thank you, my friend.
Yeah,
thank you.
I'm grateful for you too. Thank you.
This was super fun.